Hi, Heather.
Hey, how are you? I am incredibly honored to be here. I don't even think I can say in place of Mickey. I was trying to think about what I would need to do to channel Mickey, and I concluded that I just couldn't do it, so I would just have to be...
Well, why don't you just try driving all of our liberal commenters completely nuts?
I will work hard on trying to drive my fan base, who I love, completely nuts today. How's that?
Yeah, that would be a good Mickey impersonation. You could rail about the evils of illegal immigration or talk about the merits of welfare reform. But actually, those aren't your areas of expertise. So, and I should tell people who don't know, you are Heather Hurlburt, of course, executive director of the National Security Network. You blog at Democracy Arsenal. And whereas Mickey only knows more than me about particular areas of knowledge, like welfare reform and the looming perils of illegal immigration, you actually know more than me about the entire world. You're a foreign policy expert. So I thought I would interrogate you about various watershed events in the world. And there actually have been a number, if you ask me, in like the last 72 hours. And you could enlighten me as to what the story is. And in addition, you know, I think we both have an interest in kind of messaging. And in fact, you were a speechwriter for President Clinton. So maybe a couple of times we'll come back to the subject of how you would respond to the challenge that liberals face in handling national security messages in some of these areas. The liberal in question, of course, in this case being Barack Obama. And of course, the backdrop of all of this is the looming economic apocalypse. But we won't get into that. Although I noticed that in this morning's New York Times. Highest increase in consumer prices this June since 1982, and then there was a separate story saying a sense of gloom gripped Washington, and you're in Washington, so I don't know if you want to tell us what it feels like to be gripped by a sense of
Bob, just
gloom.
Remember what Phil Graham said, it's all in your mind.
It's all in your mind. Okay, so that part is okay. So then on to Iran, and I should say we're under a little time pressure because you're going to get kicked out of something in about 28 minutes. So this will be a whirlwind tour of the world. Iran, we are, right here the watershed is that we are sending, I gather, the highest level American official to make contact with the Iranian officials since the 1979 Iranian Revolution. Is that right? An undersecretary of state
yes.
or something?
Yes. It's the third, Bill Burns, who is the third highest-ranking official at the State Department, a very talented and highly regarded career diplomat. So, on the one hand, this is great news that there's a small crack in the wall of irreality in Washington about that someone has perceived that it's at least useful to appear to be negotiating with the Iranians. Moreover, the Iranians understand that. Whatever happens in the U.S., the landscape in January is going to look different than it does now. And so it's clear that the Iranians are playing the game of appearing to be cooperative and conciliatory right now and sort of daring Washington not to respond. So, you know, on the one hand, it's great news that Burns is going. On the other hand, because everybody understands that this is kind of an interregnum period, nobody should get really excited that you know, peace is going to break out. Nor should anybody be under the illusion that Bill Burns by himself makes a spring of diplomacy. And in fact, what's disappointing once you get past the headline on this one is that his instructions are basically to reiterate existing positions and not do anything else. And now, as I say, he's a smart guy that I have very high regard for. So I think, you know, we can hope that this shows that it is possible for a senior American to be in the room with Iranians and the world does not come to an end. But this is only the beginning of a long and you know, what's going to be an ugly road under the best of circumstances.
So then, from your point of view, if there's something kind of laudable about what the Bush administration is doing here, I guess you would say that it's at least smart to not look more intransigent than the Iranians, but basically all that's going on here is that particular bit of competition, to not look like we're a bigger part of the problem than they are.
Right, and also that this is kind of a necessary stop for the Europeans in order to show them that we are willing to at least, again, sit in the room with them and the Iranians. But there's, again, there's unfortunately, I'd be delighted to be proven wrong, but from what we're seeing right now, there's no reason to believe that this is the start of a great, this is the start of anything really huge in the short term.
Excellent. So we should lower our, I mean excellent in the sense that now I understand why I should not feel as good as I felt only 5 or 10 minutes ago. Thank you for that,
the
Heather.
Pall of gloom is creeping northward from Washington with every word that I utter.
You're gripped by a sense of gloom, I notice. On the Barack Obama front with Iran, of course he's been running into trouble with this flip-flop meme in general, and I think one of the several things contributing to that is that he had at one point seemed to say he would meet with any world leader unconditionally, and that would include Ahmadinejad, you would think. And then he kind of started walking that back a little, rather than standing his ground. What would you say if you were him right now? First of all, would you have handled that differently? And secondly, what would you be saying about Iran now?
Well, you know, you were raising the question of the broader messaging challenge that liberals and progressives face on these issues. And one of the things that is unfair but is just reality is that our utterances are judged differently. And because the kind of rap sheet in the public mind, and maybe even more important, the media mind, the rap sheet on liberals is that we're weak, vacillating, indecisive, and unable to use force. Anytime we shade our positions or change our minds, that looks like a flip-flop, whereas because the rap sheet on conservatives is that they're intransigent, stubborn, ideological, when they change their minds, that looks like sort of sensible moderation and thought rather than flip-flopping. So unfortunately, we're always going to be, or always until we change the meme, which is a long-term project, not an election cycle project, we're always going to be more vulnerable to the flip-flop charge, and I think Obama ran into that in spades.
And actually,
this
Iran thing is a good example. If this were a liberal president making this initiative and it were seemingly a newly kind of generous initiative, he might be accused of caving and flip-flopping, whereas Bush will be hailed as newly reasonable. So that's an example
exactly.
Right there. But go ahead
on the point about, I mean, to my mind, this business with Burns is a great example, if I thought it were backed up by a longer-term plan, of how you do diplomacy with non-friendly leaders is that you start. I mean, if I were Barack Obama on my first day in office, I could do worse than send Bill Burns out and say, okay, so come back. You know, don't just say what we've said before. Say what we've said before and then listen for a while. And come back and let's think about what we do next that leads up to a meeting that can actually either be useful or I can come back and legitimately say, hey, you know what, this guy is crazy and we can't work with him. Mm-hmm. So I always thought that the right way to read what Obama said was I would meet with him as part of a broader strategy, not I would meet with him as a one-off. And, you know, nobody thinks that you start.
Right.
You don't just sort of walk into a room and, you know, when you're out raising money for Blogging Heads, you don't just go into meetings unprepared. You have things you do in advance.
Actually, I do, as it happens, but that's just me. Most people go into meetings prepared.
Right. So again, if you wanted to layer context and nuance around what Obama originally said, I think it was completely accepting of that. And I never imagined that he really, in his own mind, thought, you know, he would wake up on January 21st, 2009, and say, you know, hey, I think I'll jet over to Tehran today. But
right.
So as long as you're willing to make that generous of an interpretation, there's no flip-flop there. But as I said, we are always going to be more subject to the flip-flop charge, and so that puts an extra burden on us. And I think his campaign is learning that the hard way right now.
Yeah, I mean, I thought he could go further and say I mean, I do think it's probably smart to say, as you suggest, look, there are 200 nations in the world. To say that I'm in principle willing to meet with any leader does not mean that you know, in early February I would be over in Tehran or they would be here. But I also think he could have kind of said something a little stronger, possibly in addition to that, which is, I'm in principle willing to meet with the guy. I wanted to go and take his measure. and say, look, you know, are you or are you not willing to be a responsible member of the global community? And if he doesn't say things that suggest that we're going to see something pretty concrete pretty soon, I will come out of that meeting and tell the world I'm very disappointed. And I'll tell you something, that'll have a lot more credibility coming from me than it would from John McCain, who has sung songs about bombing Iran. And I will also, I'll tell you another thing, I won't do what George Bush did with Putin when he went and met him and get these vaguely fuzzy good vibes and say, I saw into his soul and we're buddies. I will look for concrete things. I don't know. You tell me, would that be such a bad thing to say?
Well, it's interesting because I think the supposition behind your thinking that way is a world in which personal diplomacy is normal, is accepted, and is featured in the media and in our descriptions of what we do a lot, so that people who are sort of following it understand that that's a normal way of doing business. And whereas if you think about it for the last 8 years, that hasn't really been a significant feature of how we talk to Americans about how we approach the world. So I would argue that the problem with trying to go there right now is that there's not really a space in the public mind. That looks like much more of a shocking one-off.
I stand corrected. And we now have another reason that I've never worked in a White House and never will.
This is where I get to make my aside to the viewers and fans of Bob and say that I, in fact, first encountered you in the White House when I was working in the White House being assigned to read Non-Zero. When I worked in the Clinton White House, we had homework. We had books we were assigned to read.
And who gave you that homework?
Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton, thank you. Okay, listen, Heather, that's really all I wanted to get out of this conversation. I've got to go
so
now.
So that's the end of the dialogue.
Okay,
huh?
It's been great chatting. now that I've got that on videotape. He's been very generous in things he said about that book. And I encourage you to repeat that little anecdote wherever you go. Now, another kind of watershed that just got crossed, if crossed is what watersheds get, is this ICC thing. The ICC, I guess the prosecutor has asked for arrest warrants for Bashir, president of Sudan. He's been charged with genocide in Darfur. And this is the first time the ICC has, I guess, would have indicted a head of state. And I got to say, you know, I have, you know, a little bit of one worldish tendencies. I remember when I was at the New Republic in, I think, 1989, the 70th anniversary issue of the magazine, they asked us all to get cosmic and write something cosmic. And I wrote about the future trend toward global governance, which would be a good thing. I doubt I imagined then that within two decades, something called the International Criminal Court would be indicting a head of state. Now, that doesn't mean, I think, that this is cause for celebration by one worlders, because I'm a big believer in the need for the evolution of global governance, but watersheds can be good or bad, and if kind of milestones in the evolution, I mean there's such a thing as overreaching, there's such a thing as too much centralized power, there are things that shouldn't be handled at the global level. So in principle, I'm agnostic about all this. And also, it's important that milestones not get passed in a way that I think seems to reflect badly on global governance and winds up giving them bad PR. And in this case, a concern of some people is that this indictment is going to screw up negotiations with Sudan because the president will say, well, what do I have to lose? If dealing with the civilized world is going to lead me to wind up doing a life sentence for genocide, why go to the negotiating table? So that's the concern that's being expressed about this, and I don't know what your view is on whether this indictment would be a wise thing or not, Heather.
Well, as someone who also remembers had felt a little bit of the thrill of the One Worlder in 1989, 1990, I think that the first thing you have to draw out of this is that the whole sort of what it means to be a One Worlder now is so different. And the first way I point to that is the while the creation of the criminal court and the writing of the statute Americans were deeply involved in during the Clinton administration, its implementation and buildup over the last 6-7 years has been done, you know, completely without us, and indeed somewhat against us, with the administration's efforts, especially early on, to scare our friends and allies out of participating. So the first sort of sobering thought for the American who believes in global governance is that this display of global governance power, whatever you think about it, is something that's happened really quite independent of us. Mm-hmm. Which gives rise to some interesting thinking about power centers, and also how much the way we understand global governance has to be as kind of a multi-speed, multi-tiered thing, rather than, I think, the kind of one set of institutions centralized that people imagined back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. On the specific subject of Sudan, you know, I got my start in human rights, and so part of me just wants to cheer unconditionally anytime any terrible dictator anywhere has to quake in his boots, and I think this is a huge step in that direction. I'm very sensitive to the point you raise about negotiations, and since we have been trying fitfully to negotiate with Khartoum over Darfur, and also, by the way, to pay more attention to the peace process in South Sudan, which has been allowed to falter a bit in recent months, and there's some real concern about whether you can hold that together. And if you can't hold that together, then there's no way you can stop the fighting in Darfur. And unfortunately, you do need Bashir and his government for that. Now, having said that, an indictment is not a trial, and it's not a conviction. So I would argue that you are still in a position to do a lot of things, to offer Bashir a lot of things, to sort of and to use the indictment as part of a package on the way forward. So I'm
in a kind of not the analogy to plea bargaining isn't quite right, but there's something of that dynamic.
Exactly,
there.
Exactly, and that's I think there's so much ground for frustration with the U.S., but not just with the U.S. And I have to say, while the Bush administration has hardly been a profiling courage on this one, there aren't really any of the big Western countries that you can point to that have been willing to do more than posture in terms of actually, you know, putting some teeth into the U.N. efforts and backing up the African forces that were kind of dropped on the ground in Darfur without really ever getting the full measure of support they were promised. And so you at a certain point you use the tools you have.
Mm-hmm.
And so if there were a real negotiating process underway, and if we were actually at a juncture where we thought we might get something from Bashir, then this would have been a terrible miscoordination. But that isn't the case.
Mm-hmm.
So I think on net I come out with you know, two cheers for the cause of human rights and global governance.
Mm-hmm. Of course, there are some purists who would say that doing a deal, and of course you can imagine a deal getting done, because as you said, a lot of things have to happen. I mean, first of all, the judges, before Bashir's in deep trouble, I mean, first of all, the judges have to grant the warrant, I guess, the international judges. I think the Security Council, either it has to authorize something or it certainly has the power to override.
That's right.
And, I mean, interestingly, just as a footnote we don't have time to get into, China is not enthusiastic about this development, and they have veto power on the Security Council.
Just a reminder on that, China is unenthusiastic, A, because it has significant oil investments in in Sudan, and B, because the Chinese perceive this very much as related to problems they have with Tibet and Xinjiang and other autonomous regions, and never like to see any infringement on the power of a head of state. So just to remember why that
is. Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, there are a lot of heads of state who aren't enthusiastic about what the ICC might do to a head of state, possibly including George Bush. I mean, I think those fears are hugely exaggerated,
but it's an issue with a number. That's a complete red herring, and I'm just going to interrupt you and shut you down on that one, just because that should be so comprehensively disproven at every turn that until George Bush succeeds in sabotaging our court system a whole lot more than he has done to date, the ICC has no ability to do anything to Americans, because we have what's recognized as a fully functioning court system.
Ah, fascinating. There you go. The things I learned from talking to you. There is, you know, you can't imagine this, you kind of using this as leverage to get him to do a deal. I think one worlder purists might say, but wait a second, you know, that's not the rule of law. This really isn't a close analogy to plea bargaining per se. It's not like, okay, now you'll go through the judicial process and only get 10 years instead of life. It's like you're getting concessions in a quite different realm in a certain sense from the judicial realm by using the threat of the rule of law. There are probably purists who would not like that. My own view is, look, global governance is going to evolve in kind of fits and starts, and it's going to be a lot of jerry-built stuff. And the main thing is that there be successful application of it. And, you know, one thing I didn't like about launching the Iraq War was because it was such an opportunity to set the precedent that the UN could forcefully impose arms inspections that would work, but that's a hobby horse I'm getting off onto. Anyway, my view is, you know, global governance will probably never look like national governance, and maybe that's a good thing that it never had quite such systematic power, but you do what you can.
Well, just to make a bold excursion off topic, I think the experience of the European Union over the years since 1989 is the best example we've got of why trying to make global governance look like national governance is not a good idea, and how that actually turns out not to be what people want.
Because it overreached into areas that really shouldn't necessarily be part of international governance, you mean?
Well, because on the one hand, technology allows us, and it turns out people actually prefer to keep some aspects of governance sort of close to home and familiar and small scale where they feel that they can have influence over it. Second, large bureaucracies just aren't appealing, and nobody has yet found a way to make them more appealing. So nobody has yet really figured out how to maintain the level of support for a large supranational entity. And as I say, if the EU, which has everything going for it in terms of both money and resources, a relatively stable environment, and a real sort of self-concept that most other parts of the world don't have, and if the EU can't, if this is the best go the EU can make of it, that should be a very sobering message for one-worlders everywhere else.
Yeah. I mean, didn't
And I'm not, by the way, downplaying the EU's achievement, which is really quite stupendous.
Yeah,
but
no,
to look at how much it's cost and how difficult it's been and how stalled it is, and to say to yourself, okay, now imagine trying to replicate that in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, hasn't the EU even tried to get into the regulation of lifestyle issues like abortion, or am I wrong?
Yeah.
I mean, that seems to me crazy. Have they done that?
Well, there's different tiers of European institutions, and, for example, the European Court has tried to overrule some national laws on lifestyle issues, or people have appealed national court rulings on lifestyle issues to the European Court, and there's been a real sort of fight about what's called subsidiarity.
Okay.
So, if I were it, I would
tread carefully in and lifestyle and social issues on which there are very different views in different nations.
Yes. And just to get on one of my hobby horses here, I mean, what you see from the sort of early 90s was this enormous enthusiasm on the part of European elites to really create a pan-European set of institutions governing, you know, all aspects of daily life and imposing a kind of European liberal set of norms. And that was just a gross overreach in terms of what the public wanted, and there was a failure to sell it. And it turns out, you know, people in Poland are much more conservative on social issues and want to stay that way, thank you very much. And people in the UK have a very different set of views on economic issues and want to stay that way, thank you. And then there's the case of Switzerland, and you see that European elites in the early 90s completely discounted that. And it's not in some ways dissimilar to some of the things that have happened in the U.S. in terms of, I think, elites thinking that Americans were more ready for a new set of social mores than Americans in some parts of the country actually were, and how what seems perfectly reasonable to me seems like a major threat to the way of life of someone else. And where you can avoid threatening people's ways of life, you probably should.
Okay. I will avoid that myself in the future. Afghanistan. We move on our march around the world. We move from the European Union to Afghanistan. A lot of worst ever headlines coming out of Afghanistan lately. This is the most number of people killed in a terrorist attack in Afghanistan since the war started, you know, whenever in 2002 or 2003, or most number of Americans killed in one blow. Things seem to be heading south in Afghanistan. I think you have some ideas about how far south they're headed.
Well, people who remember history will remember that others have tried before to remake Afghanistan in their image and failed pretty dramatically, both the British and then, of course, the Soviets. And what has happened since 2001 is that both you had an initial effort in Afghanistan that was quite successful, and then the administration let itself get totally distracted by Iraq, pulled out the special forces who were hunting bin Laden, you know, dramatic decrease and lack of attention on the economic and social reconstruction side, sort of really alienating our European and NATO allies who we were depending on to help us both on the military side and on the reconstruction side. So on the one hand, we haven't been doing the job very thoroughly. And on the other hand, you know, as in Iraq, a real kind of over-promising in terms of, you know, we're going to make Afghanistan into the Switzerland of Central Asia, these kind of fantasias about the level of functioning democracy that we would create, so that you're now, I think, and you know, this is a real messaging challenge going forward, because the short-term concern is you've got to pay more attention. You know, you have
You mean
Admiral
it's a
Mullen.
Challenge for Obama in particular?
Yeah, well, it's a challenge for Obama right now to say, hey, we've got to pay more attention. You know, John, my staff pointed out
isn't
yesterday.
Isn't it a gift to Obama in the sense that, you know, Iraq seems to be getting better and better, and that's kind of ambiguous for him, because on the one hand, McCain can say I was right about the surge. On the other hand, of course, Obama's plan to pull out early looks less crazy. In any event, as for the kind of the kind of problematic side of Iraq from Obama's point of view, the deterioration in Afghanistan, I mean, to be cynical about it and talk in purely public relations terms, is almost like a gift, in that the conventional wisdom absolutely is that Iraq got us distracted from Afghanistan. And it seems to me the theme that Obama should be hitting just overridingly is this is the price we pay for losing our focus, right? So, I mean, on balance, in political terms, this is good for Obama, right?
I actually, because of the problem I mentioned before, anytime there's mass instability and American troops getting killed, that tends to push a certain group of Americans in a more conservative thinking direction, and it heightens people's fears. So, I mean, besides the fact that I never like to see things going badly on the merits, I also think that progressives should be very careful before they wish for things to go badly anywhere.
Well, I'm not saying we should actually wish for it,
right.
But, you know, when it happens and calling attention to it would help your guy get elected president, you might make note of it. Is
right.
All I'm
I
saying.
Guess, Bob, what I'm saying is that when there's instability, that cuts both ways, that it both heightens the critique of the current administration's failed policies. And by the way, John McCain, my staff went on his website yesterday, and at the beginning of the day yesterday, there was apparently pretty much nothing about Afghanistan on McCain's website. By the end of the day, that had been rectified, but, you know, the guy just doesn't care about Afghanistan, hasn't been paying any attention to it. But at the same time, there is, you know, the effect we know that the more instability there is in the world, the more Americans are getting killed in the world, the more that does drive a certain segment of the electorate in a conservative direction. So it isn't necessarily something that pushes people toward progressive models of national security, even though from a purely analytical point of view, you would think that it should. But
I guess I would say if the news is out there already, you know, it's kind of an empirical question how many people read the papers enough to know that Afghanistan is heading south. But if you assume that a lot of people are getting that sense anyway, it does seem to me it's in Obama's interest to emphasize that had we kept our focus on Afghanistan rather than moving it to Iraq and our resources, we might be in much better shape and the world would be a much more stable place.
Well, actually, I think there's an even more forward-looking message that Obama is using and which I think is a good thing to use, which is this is a place that progressives will use the military assertively, do have an idea of what a military is for and how to use it in a way that's against a threat that's very clear and obvious to Americans, the guys who attacked us on 9/11. So it's a forward-looking message, which is a good one.
And what is the way that progressives want to use the forces that is distinctive?
That you actually put enough forces in Afghanistan and in the right places and on the border with Pakistan and put more of a focus on working with the Pakistani government, that you can, A, actually be serious again about hunting down bin Laden and not give him freedom of movement in the Pakistani hinterlands and freedom to reorganize as the intelligence community says that he has. Second, you both with U.S. forces and by showing that we're committed so you can actually get more support from the Europeans, which right now the Europeans look at us and say, well, you're not really committed to this, so why should we be losing our people there, to check the return of the Taliban into certain regions, which is why you're seeing the headlines, you're seeing the increased casualties, you're seeing, you know, the huge and well-coordinated assaults on a NATO base the other day, and that needs a sustained pushback in the short term. So that's kind of the immediate progressive response that you can talk about right now and that you could implement in the next 6 to 12 months that would actually make a significant difference and give the Afghans back some breathing space to address the very significant, painfully significant corruption problem they've got throughout their government that is sort of the other unspoken piece of this that you can't address with military forces and that you can't address just by the U.S. government wanting it to happen, but there actually has to be this sustained attention that says, okay, we're not telling you you have to look like Switzerland, but these are the baselines that we need to get to in order not to lose what's already been gained in Afghanistan. And that's it's a long-term problem, and it's an ugly problem, and it's one that doesn't message. This is where we need to actually get away from messaging and be able to do foreign policy in all of its messy, nasty, suboptimal, not like a Disney movie reality. That Afghanistan is an extremely poor place with very little history of of democratic government that folks were promised when we went into Afghanistan. So in order to help the Afghans, you know, find a way to stability that doesn't involve the draconian levels that the Taliban took it to, and that there can be progress toward economic and social freedom for people there, but that's a long-term process, and it's, as I say, it's not one that's subject to the kind of optimistic pronouncements that Americans are now accustomed to after 6 years of this administration telling them how great things were going to be.
Yeah, well, it also has very little history of successful centralized governance, period. Leave democracy aside. So how long before you get kicked out of this office that you're in and we have to bring this to a close?
Well, it's an interesting question because at one point I thought that we were going to be interrupted by the staff meeting of the Enough Project, and I figured they'd start walking in and we could just ask them about the indictment of Bashir.
Yeah.
But it's 11 and they haven't walked in, so let's try to talk 5-10 more minutes and see what happens. And as
okay.
I say, if they walk in, we'll conduct a Blogging Heads group interview.
And they're liberals, so you can probably just intimidate them and they'll back off.
Actually, I regret to say I hear them coming en masse right now.
Oh, God. What do you think?
Why don't we shut this down, and I'll hop to another office and hop back on, and we can tape the last 5 minutes as a separate.
Oh, okay, that's wise.
Okay, so let me just call you back.
See you soon. Hi, Heather, we're back.
I'm back.
And in the meanwhile, you had an inspiration, right?
I did. I was lucky enough to be ejected from my taping site by the staff of the Enough Project, which works to end genocide in a number of places. And so I put to them the question that we were discussing about the Bashir indictment. And the informed answer is that there's now, the way that the process works, the judges have a 3-month period to look at the indictment and decide whether and how to proceed. So the sort of strong message to the Security Council is, okay, you now have a 3-month window where there's more pressure on Bashir, but it's unclear what the outcome of the indictment is. Thus, if you choose to use it, this is a 3-month window to press Bashir to negotiate and really make some progress, with the understanding that then the Security Council has the influence to has the ability to influence what does or doesn't happen to the indictment. So this, the decision by the prosecutors to go ahead and do this creates some leverage. Now it's up to the members of the Security Council to actually use the leverage to get something done.
So you can imagine this actually becoming a kind of standard procedure, a standard
mm-hmm.
tool. I mean, the
yes.
system, the judicial kind of process here lends itself to using it to put pressure on people to do deals.
Yep. And as you said earlier, that may be somewhat distasteful to purists, but in fact, something I wanted to say at the time is that the domestic judicial system is used that way too. In ways that are sometimes good and sometimes maybe an abuse of power, but it's not at all uncommon to, say, go after one defendant, to push other defendants to settle, to bring a very strong indictment, to encourage a defendant to move toward a plea bargain, and so on. So while it isn't sort of the textbook way that you set up, that you use a court system, it is in fact the way court systems are used in the U.S. and other countries.
Yeah. Or even to threaten them with indictment in order to get them to testify, which arguably is as potentially corrupting as just about anything you can imagine, since it's an incentive for them to lie in some cases. But anyway, in our domestic system we do that. So you're right, the domestic system is not entirely pure itself.
Yeah.
Okay, I wanted to quickly tie together several things under the rubric of this Barack flip-flop meme. It has both a domestic policy dimension and a foreign policy dimension. On the foreign policy front, what strikes me as ironic is that there have been several issues feeding into the Barack flip-flop meme. It seems to me that most of the attention focus on the, in a way, not least consequential one, but the supposed flip-flop, which should have been least surprising and ultimately least momentous. What I mean by that is this. I mean, there's been, they've complained that, he backed off of a seeming willingness to negotiate with any world leader anywhere, once they started asking him about evil leaders in particular. B, there was the AIPAC speech and the now famous phrase, undivided Jerusalem. And then C, there's the Iraq thing, and it seemed to me that of all of the positions, the one that was most predictable and should have been least surprising to anyone is that he's not going to be able to stick to this 16-month withdrawal thing. He's going to have to amend that to some point. It seemed to me that what the movement should have held his feet to the fire on is get him to say unequivocally, say fine, make it 24 months, whatever, but get him to say unequivocally, no permanent basis if that's what they want. So it just seems to me ironic that the idea that okay, maybe the troops won't be out there in 16 months led to the most heated kind of charges of flip-flop, it seems to me. Does any of that make sense to you?
Well, I mean, the first sort of just point of clarification is he has very explicitly said no permanent basis.
Now, has he said that? I had heard that he had. I kind of said that last week, and then I read reports that he hadn't quite said that per se. But he has said, absolutely, by the time I leave office, there will be no military bases in Iraq. No.
What you just said is different from no permanent bases.
Okay. Well, that's a deadline that's plausible. And anyway, that's the kind of thing I would think the movement should absolutely insist on. And, the 16 versus 20-month thing is kind of silly. But anyway. On the AIPAC speech, I know you have... you have more experience in this area than I do and know more about the whole history of things that are said and official phraseology in the realm of Israel. Of course, what he said was, yes, we absolutely need a two-state solution, but Jerusalem must, I mean, there's an ellipse in there somewhere, and this is a paraphrase, but Jerusalem must remain undivided, which was interpreted as meaning Palestinians won't get one square inch of it, of even East Jerusalem, which, of course, means no deal in real terms, but and that's what he took heat on from Palestinians, including the chief negotiator Mahmoud Abbas, took heat from the left in America. But you know more about this than I do, and I think you have some historical context.
Well, as I was saying to you when we got to chatting about this the other day, back in the day when I worked on these with some regularity, undivided Jerusalem meant Jerusalem is undivided, everyone can go everywhere, and whether that happens under some kind of international oversight, whether the two sides agree to share custody of it, was the understanding was always that was left for final status negotiations, but undivided doesn't mean doesn't have to mean undivided and wholly Israeli. Now, I will freely acknowledge that it was a lot easier to imagine Jerusalem as an international city 10 years ago than it is now. But, you know, when Obama said that, he wasn't making some kind of new gigantic concession to the Israelis. He was using phraseology that lots of progressives have used for a long time, with the understanding that Jerusalem's final status is going to be one of the most sensitive issues, that it's going to be negotiated between the parties, and that at a certain point an American president is going to have to help sort of shape a vision that, everybody can get behind. But I actually felt like the extent of the excitement over this was somewhat reflective of, the extent to which nobody's felt like there was any point in paying attention to this issue for a while, because there was just no movement at all going on. And so suddenly there is movement again, and you have, you know, one of the things that's wonderful about progressives in our field right now is a whole generation of people who've come to the issues since 9/11, and who, frankly, for better, mostly for better, weren't paying attention the last time we went through this set of issues, and so we go through them all over again. And in a lot of ways, that's good. It brings in new energy. It challenges people's perceptions. It changes the boundaries of what it's okay to say and what it's not okay to say. But it's a place where, when you have people working with Obama who, like me, or much more so than me, actually have been steeped in these issues for a decade or more, and to them, undivided Jerusalem has one set of meanings that only goes so far. Whereas to someone who just picks it up and reads it, it meant, as you say, the kind of thing that got the left so excited. But I it didn't mean that to the people who put it in the speech. I would just swear my life on that.
Okay. I mean, I would say that, you know, the very formulation, yes, we need a two-state solution, but, I mean, he's talking to AIPAC. You know that whatever comes after the but is going to mean, but there's one thing the Palestinians won't get. You know, I mean, that has to be the meaning of what follows. So it just seems to me that if you look at the thing in context, you almost don't need to know what comes in the, you know, that he's going to say undivided Jerusalem. You know that whatever he puts there should be interpreted as, but damn it, the Palestinians won't get this. I think it's totally natural it was interpreted that way. And I think also, you know, as you kind of either said or implied, these days nobody means international Jerusalem when they say undivided Jerusalem. I mean that is off the table, with a possible exception of the old city itself. So I still find that thing very, very puzzling. But maybe it's just me.
Back to the broader point you made, that it's really worth sort of putting all of these things in that context, where, you know, Obama is the prisoner of his remarkable rhetorical skills and the remarkable excitement he's generated, in that he's trying to deliver simple, straightforward messages to multiple audiences at the same time. And after, you know, after 8 years of a president who really did use these kind of dog whistle, sort of using little bits of hymn tunes in speeches to signal things to parts of the conservative base or whatever, it's very refreshing to see Obama try as hard as he can to be very straightforward and to say things that will excite and inspire the base, while also staying within the bounds of, you know, on my issues in particular, what the international community is used to hearing. And that is extraordinarily difficult to do.
Yeah.
And so I just, you know, my and now I haven't done a great job of being Mickey and ticking off the base, but I'll try. And one thing I just would say is, you know, the guy is trying to do something really extraordinary, and he deserves. He deserves a lot of benefit of the doubt from the base, and he deserves for the base to take a deep breath and say, okay, you know, this guy is very smart and very thoughtful and trying to do something very difficult, and maybe he has reasons for these things, and maybe we should at least stop and pause and think about what they are before we hit the panic button.
Okay, I will... I'm tempted to reply, but I've done enough nitpicking on that, and I've taken some heat from the base.
And there are lots of nits to pick. I mean,
what's that?
I'm not at all saying there are lots of nits to pick. So it's
yeah.
Not, but that in the context of where we are right now, where mm-hmm. we're trying to go, and frankly, the
yeah.
enormity of the mountain that we are trying to push up.
Right.
And I have to say, the other thing is, as much as I worry about winning the election, in some ways, I worry even more about the 6 months after the election, where I think all of us who spend a lot of time thinking about how we want the world to look can name off so many things that we want to see, and yet we're going to face a very resource-poor environment. We're going to face a pretty hostile international environment that, you know, may be very ecstatic to see Barack Obama elected, but also is going to say, okay, now show us. You know, you show us that you're serious before we do much of anything for you. And, you know, we're going to face being bogged down in a couple big military excursions that have gone wrong and that are just going to take a lot of time to extract ourselves from. And so people, there's going to be a lot of disappointment that even Barack Obama is not going to be able to make all the bad stuff go away, you know, on January 22nd. And people need to, and all of us need to be thinking about ways to keep all the great energy and enthusiasm that we have while having a very realistic and sober view of just how long it's going to take to undo the damage of 8 years.
No, another reason I'm more willing to cut him some slack is, you know, the polls have closed and between him and McCain to some extent. And I think partly it's because the flip-flop meme stuck, and partly it stuck because his base got so outraged by some of this stuff. And my feeling at the time was, well, you got to hold his feet to the fire on certain issues, and I think to some extent the base does. But of course, you want to fine tune it so that he doesn't quite lose the election over adherence to his base. So I'm forced to choose between holding his feet to the fire and getting him elected. I vote for getting him elected. I should spend a little time with commenter issues, as I do when Mickey is here, and he rolls his eyes when I do this. So you can roll your eyes if you want. He finds the comments boring or something, or annoying maybe, since a number of them are directed against him.
Well, I just have to say that I was so inspired by the last round of commenters' sort of discursions on musical topics, which was just fantastic and way more informative than what Eli and I had to say on that subject. So that stuff is great. There is a certain amount of eye rolling that I do, although I think you guys have also done a great job of removing some of the more kind of objectionable stuff that was there the first couple times I did this, and that by and large it's a really great, at least the folks who hang out with Eli and me are a really great group of commenters.
Yeah, we don't actually remove many comments, and when we do, now we have the technology to leave them in the forum and just leave and take them off the video page. But they have to be pretty outrageous and ad hominem and devoid of substance. I mean, I'm guessing we've done that once per like 5,000 comments or something. I mean, we just almost never do it.
Well, the thing I had in mind, and this I hesitate to say this because it'll unleash a torrent of comment on the comment on the comment. But what I noticed is that the first couple of rounds, the sort of sheer novelty of having a woman up on screen, there was a fair amount of sort of maybe extraneous commentary about the fact that I have a gap between my two front teeth and so on and so forth. But that's, of course, now I am inflaming it again by mentioning it, but I was really grateful that everybody got over what I look like and was able to get back to talking about, you know, what we were talking about, which I was very impressed by.
There have been nasty comments about the appearance of males, too, if that makes you feel any better. But we do, it's true, we do have a largely male audience, and there may be more attention given to the appearance of, I think if it's any consolation, they pulled Rosa Brooks into that motif.
Rosa got that much worse than I did, or much better than I did, depending on how you look at it. It's just, I don't know. There are other places you can go if the appearance of people on the screen is what's really important to you.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, almost every video website would give you more to talk about in that regard. But I'm glad you like our current commenters by and large. Quickly, first of all, Graz, G-R-A-Z, commenter, points out that I got something wrong last time. I said that I thought McCain had distanced himself from Reverend Hagee, who dissed Catholicism, but not Reverend Parsley, who dissed Islam. I was wrong. McCain has distanced himself from both. That's wonderful. If it's now official that both Republican and Democratic presidential candidates have to distance themselves from people who are disrespectful to Islam and not only to some Christian religion, that's wonderful. Glad I got it. Glad I was wrong. B.J. Keefe complains he's a very prolific commenter because I called him benign. Now, does benign sound like an insult or backhanded compliment to you?
Well, I really like B.J., actually, but now I'm afraid to say anything about him because he'll be insulted if he thought benign was an insult. So, B.J., I don't know.
See, I think he's not looking at the classical roots of the... He reprimanded me and said I should go look at a thesaurus if I don't know how insulting the word benign is. You know, he's thinking modern medical terms, I think. Benign just means, okay, you're not quite
not
causing
malignant,
cancer
right.
on the website. If you look at the still recognized meanings of benign that were prior in time, but are still recognized meanings, but originated earlier, they include things like, it seems like I had them here, of gentle disposition, see synonyms at gracious, showing kindness and gentleness, see synonyms at favorable and wholesome. You know, you hear, you know, like the sun shining benignly on the plants and so on. And in fact, if you look into the etymology, okay, it said it is to beget, if you look at the Latin. So it means quite the opposite of meaning kind of, you know, of kind of having these kind of male menopause-y connotations that
what?
The commenter said it has. It means virile. It means prolific.
Okay, well, all I'm going to say about that is, BJ, since from time to time I get accused of being too nice by the commenters, I feel your pain.
Okay, so you and BJ, the bond strengthens between you and BJ. Now, quickly, on this Ann Althaus thing that you probably don't know about, but I made the comment that I thought it would be hard to find a comment section on the web where you had more vigorous disagreement covering often a sizable ideological gap that was conducted in more civil terms, right? Because most comment sections are, you know, kind of preaching to the choir comment sections of just you know, associated with a single blogger, and the commenters are basically his fan club or her fan club. And if you see dissent, it often gets kind of bitter and flame war-y, except over kind of minor issues. And I said, where would you find a comment section like this? Ann Althaus, the noted blogger Ann Althaus, embedded the clip of me saying that and saying, well, you would find it in our comment section, of course. So I had this idea, and I want to see what our commenters think of this, of trying an experiment in cross-fertilization where we, like maybe some of our commenters go over to Ann Althaus's comment section on you know, certain issues and engage them where there might be disagreement, and have competition to see who can be more civil in more you know, and at the same time be disagreeing in a substantively contentious way. And then, you know, her commenters could come over here and they would identify themselves as, you know, being from the Althaus blog, and we would have this award in, like, civility, you know? So I'm not calling for this to happen right now. I want to see what our commenters, whether they think this is crazy. But, I mean, I actually predict that if we invade Ann Althaus's comment section, we will be greeted as liberators. And these people who think that living under Ann's rule has been so wonderful will realize that once they've felt the breeze of true pluralism, that they have been living under tyranny.
Well, in that regard, I actually want to offer a shout-out to my commenters over at Democracy Arsenal, because they, I have to say, we get a certain amount of love, but there's also really a very good amount of holding our feet to the fire, and that they really see their job as keeping us on the path of truth and light, and pushing us pretty hard when we stray off it, which I appreciate almost as much as I do just sheer flat-out love, flowers, and candy.
Well, should you link to this dialogue or part of it on Democracy Arsenal, should you be possessed to do that, or better yet, even embed it, you might encourage them to come over here and mix it up a little. We could encourage, we could have like three-way cross-fertilization or something.
Okay, very good.
That's a good way to end. Well, thank you. Okay. You have been more than Mickey, I would say. And I would have thought such a thing not even imaginable only a week ago, but you've been more than Mickey.
I am going to put that on the bottom of my emails today. More than Mickey, Robert Wright.
And write a book, and it's a blurb from me, okay?
Great.